The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Today we're going back to 2001 for an interview I did with a book that was one of my favorite works of fiction that year, written by J.N. Stroyer. It's called The Children's War.
Good afternoon, Miami Valley, and welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program today J.N. Stroyer. Her book is The Children's War. Welcome to Ohio.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, I understand that you come to us via a fairly circuitous route.
Yes, I was up in Cleveland yesterday and Miami before that. And
I mean your life.
Oh, my life. Well, heavens. Yes, I've been moving around a lot. I started my career in physics Well, I got my doctorate nearly 20 years ago, and that was a good time for physicists to look for jobs abroad. And so that's what I did, and I've been traveling pretty much ever since. Maybe I'm even addicted to it. I thought I was a settled person, but I ended up just traveling, always looking and finding out about new places, new cultures. And I think that's what led to a lot of the book, was meeting people through my job and through the cultures that I met and people that I met in various places.
Now, is this your first book?
Yes, it is, and it wasn't even intentional. I wrote everything down because I needed to write it down, and I had it on a file and on my computer. As my part of my job, I'm rather constantly working on computers. And the number of times I just sort of thought maybe I just hit the delete button were quite a few. And then after a long time, it sat there, and I just sort of took on a life of its own, and I thought, well, maybe other people might like to read it. And so I went through it again and rewrote it for an audience. And somebody picked up on it, which sort of surprised me.
You have a lot to say.
In the book, you mean?
In the book, yes.
Oh, yes, yes. It started with, more than 20 years ago, going behind the, I guess it was called the Iron Curtain at the time, and talking to people there and learning all about sort of their stories and what went on. And I found that it was extremely sad how, in American culture, we sort of get used to the idea that you're going to have the end of the book or the end of the movie and everything's fine. And I think we treat our news the same way. I mean, if something happens in Rwanda, we hear about it, then it goes away. And we don't hear about what happens before, what led to it. We don't hear about what happens afterwards. You might know that people aren't currently killing each other in Lebanon simply because it isn't in the news. But when they're killing each other, then it's in the news. And so we get this sort of feeling that crises come and go, and afterwards everything's fine. And certainly from TV, you get that impression. And I was sort of stunned by how affected people were, people in my own family were, by things that had happened to them many, many years ago, and how it stuck with them, and how important it still was to their lives, and also to the lives of everybody around them. As time went on, I began working occasionally behind the Soviet in the Soviet Union on conferences and things, and I met other East Bloc physicists, and you know, I talked to them, and everybody had a story, and it, you know, I just accepted that and went on my way and kept these things rattling around in my head. Then a few years later, I was working in Belgium, and lo and behold, I met asylum seekers. The country has very many people seeking asylum, mostly Africans and other third world countries, and people with very unfamiliar cultures and languages and religions. And yet they seem to be telling the same story. And it just struck me as so strange. It was still happening just to different people, different cultures. And I wanted to tell their story. I didn't really want to. I just sort of had to. It was stuck in my mind long after I left them behind and moved on to another country, that time Germany. Their story stayed with me. And it was clear that it stayed with them, too. They, you know, had escaped quite horrible oppression. And you would think, you know, it's the happy end. They're going to get accepted for asylum in Belgium or whatever. And it wasn't the happy end. It really did stay with them. And it stayed with me, too. And I began to think, how would I feel? And so after a while, I just started writing down everybody's story. And the book is about 90% true stories. The more wild it is, the truer it is. The 10% that's fiction is the sort of smoothing over bits, the bits that make it seem like a, just normal people.
As they say, truth is stranger.
Yes, and I think that being a scientist, I was very, very careful. I didn't want to take liberties with history. And so what I did was I went back and started researching more and more things about these people, but I realized I could never tell their story in a context that I just didn't know enough about their countries. And while I was living in Germany and got very familiar with German culture and the German language and German people, I did realize we were very familiar with World War II, and I also had a lot of stories from World War II. And so I just combined them all into one story about many people, as it were, and that's why it became a somewhat large book.
So it's a work of fiction, but it's based on many, many, many true stories, and the end result, 1,149 pages, The Children's War, written by J.N. Stroyer. She joins us in studio in the Book Nook. I know a lot of our listeners out there have never read a book this long, and you would think that this would be a monumental task, that people would be intimidated by a book of this size. When I finished the book, I wanted more. I wanted another 1,000 pages. I loved it that much.
I have heard that from other people. I've heard also from spouses of people who've read it, you know, thank goodness I have my husband back or something like that, or wife, and depending on the person. It seems to surprisingly draw in many people, and that pleases me, obviously, because I do have a message buried in all the fiction or in all the story, as it were. I didn't want to make it ponderous. I didn't want to write a philosophical treatise. I just wanted to expand upon these ideas in my own mind and find out what the price of war is, what the price of freedom is, and what individual responsibility is. And so you finished all the way through the book, I take it then.
Oh, I had such a feeling of exultation when I finished, but I also had a feeling of wanting more, and I think that's a sign of a very enjoyable book. And of course, I'm not going to give away any of the juicy stuff in the book, but suffice it to say, the main character is a fellow named Peter Halifax, or is that Alan, or is that Nicholas? He's got a problem with his papers.
Yes, that at least starts things off. He's plummeted from a sort of very normal position in society. To the very bottom. And so many times stories are told about alternate worlds or past history, and it's about the aristocracy or about the people who are running things. And I just wanted to see, well, what is it like when you're truly on the bottom of one of these societies? And certainly I'd met enough people who fell into that category. And so at the beginning, he doesn't even have a name. He's just stripped of absolutely every sign of his humanity, and he slowly, you know, claws his way back to being a human through the story, and not with a lot of help from other people. Sometimes it seems they, en route, there's a lot of people who can make a lot of use of him, and so he's struggling just to find himself after having been torn out of the world and find that he can actually belong again, as it were. And I think that's the story of a lot of people that I talked to and read about, too. I started doing some more research, and I'd find it's quite amazing years later to find out that somebody who you thought had escaped kills himself. And that's a very strong statement that they clearly hadn't. And, you know, why would somebody commit suicide 20, 30, 40 years after something terrible has happened to them? And that was a sort of always playing through my mind, is why do they do this? And indeed, why did one of my friends do this? It's, you know, sort of that question is treated throughout the book, as I just try to answer it from the point of view of, well, what would I have felt like? Or what would any other person who considers themselves a normal person, a person to whom these sort of things don't happen? We have a view of the world where nasty things happen to certain sorts of people. If you're in China, you can expect, you know, to be executed for tax fraud. Or if you're in Africa, you might expect to starve because of a war. And you say, well, that's not us. It's not going to happen to us. And this is perhaps one recent incident in the world where it proves it does happen to us. That is the safe part of the world. And perhaps I should have said it in America to make it even more clear, but the Third Reich seemed a more plausible story.
I think here in our culture, we feel pretty complacent about our freedom. We feel very sheltered, very protected, almost nurtured by our affluence. And I don't think we ask those hard questions. If we were being tortured, if we were being humiliated, terrorized on a constant basis, would we continue to choose to live? What would make us want to survive? I kept thinking of a film that I saw years ago as I read your book. Maybe you've seen it. I think it was a Lena Wertmuller film that takes place in a concentration camp, and there's a prisoner who just can't stand it anymore, and at one point he just chooses to dive into a pool of excrement and drown rather than live in this kind of a world. It's like, how does someone survive through this? And as I was reading your book, there's so much terror, there's so much oppression, and yet there are glimmers of humor, there are glimmers of hope that keep the reader going through all the stuff that's going on, and it's really powerful.
Well, I did want to make the people human, and you don't want to make people so depressed that they won't read it. And also, it's always worth remembering, even, you know, stories about heroes or whatever, the people were human throughout it all. They had to do very normal human things and try to maintain their own touch with themselves. In the book, one of the questions, I mean, you mentioned about why people, you know, how they could survive something like a concentration camp or something. And what was quite saddening, I think, is many people do survive. It's afterwards when they look forward to this day when they will be free and they're so sure it's going to happen. And then when they're free, nothing is like they expected it to be. Nightmares don't go away. And that was also an important point for me is I read a couple of books from survivors who would write things about friends who would kill themselves and say, how could they have done that? You know, this is a terrible thing to do. And then you looked at the foreword of the book and find out the writer had killed himself. And it was just a stunning, you know, revelation. There they wrote this life-affirming chapter, and then the next thing you know, they'd committed suicide. And many people find different things to hold on to and what can make their lives worthwhile. And you can ask the same question about us. I mean, what makes our lives worthwhile as well? And perhaps an ideology helps or a religion. If you don't have those particular things, though, and the world around you is sort of collapsing, you do have to say, what is it that makes people want to keep going, and especially after they've achieved what they thought was the solution and then find out it really isn't?
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. Since 1958, it's the best of the book. Nick, we'll continue with my 2001 interview with J.M. Stroyer right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO with my 2001 interview with J.N. Stroyer for one of my favorite novels of that year. It was called The Children's War.
I think my favorite character was Carl.
Oh.
The villain.
Yes.
I love Carl. You just love to hate this guy. he is so wonderfully drawn. I mean, we all know people like Carl, who are bombastic, who are pompous, who are petty, who are brutal, who are sadistic. You know, maybe not to his extent, but we all have known people with these elements. And you just love to hate this guy, but you really had fun with him, didn't you?
I think I did, yes. perhaps even modeling him on some people that I know, or at least partially, like you said. And in fact, the one thing he is as well is self-pitying. It's amazing that somebody in such a position of power could sit there and whine about themselves, but I've seen that as well. It is quite amazing. He falls in the category of my belief that in a society that is as oppressive as this, scum rises to the top. And so as soon as you get to the this not being the U.S., but I think that you're going to meet the very worst people when you start looking at the political machinery of something like the Third Reich. And so it wasn't a comment on the general characteristics of people, but perhaps the sort of people who would be in power, be in the security ministry, which is, I figured, one of the nastiest places you could be in, one of the nastiest regimes on the world. And I believe that the vanity and all that other sort of stuff, well, I guess I've even seen it in communist regimes when the local politician felt the need to come by and, address the physics conference and tell you about tractor production. And you could just sort of see their vanity and their belief in how wonderful they are. And at the same time, they could be, taking part in an incredibly self-deluding regime and amazingly, geared towards just self-enrichment and self-aggrandizement. And then say it was in the name of the people, which is the same sort of thing the Nazis did. I mean, it was a workers' party movement, and it was supposed to be for the workers. But you know that at the end of it all, it was for the gangsters who got to the top.
And the regime that you describe struck me as a hybrid, in a way, what we think of in some of the former Eastern Bloc countries, like East Germany, the corruption that they had at the top. There seems to be a hybrid going on here. Let's talk a minute about the kind of country that we have. As the reader opens the book, we see a map. Let's talk about what the world is and who owns what.
My thesis was that the Nazi-Soviet pact held. And so the line that was pretty much drawn in 1939 or a bit later as various territory was taken over, held in there between the Soviet Union and Germany. Countries in Asia, for instance, I imagine be pretty much run on a patriarchy. The United States, Canada, and Quebec unite into a North American Union and are host to a bunch of governments in exile who are themselves so dissociated from their people anymore that they've become sort of their own special interest group. You almost think that perhaps they like the things the way they are because they can be a government without even having to run a country. And in Germany and the Reich itself, the Reich expanded to become all the territory that was considered in some way native German becomes the Reich. There's other designations for various countries. I felt that if a country had been neutral during the war, they probably would manage to have maintained some level of autonomy, but probably not as much as they would have liked. And so those places I incorporated into protectorates. And if they had actively fought, I assumed they would be incorporated into Reich law, or either under military or civilian government. And if they, joined the Nazis in their as an Axis power, then I figured they probably had better status. And so the map drawn is pretty much based upon that, where you even see a partition of France between the bit that was Vichy and the bit that was controlled as Nazi Reich-held territory.
I think the most intriguing character is Richard. Richard is an amazing character, and I don't feel comfortable really saying anything about him because...
Yes, he's a bit of an enigma.
Yeah, I mean, you really can't even describe who he is without giving away stuff.
he's the one thing that is a constant for him is his thirst for power. His motives might change in your mind, but his thirst to absolutely grab power. And he's one of the few people who... who explicitly is not burdened by ideology, doesn't believe one word of the Aryan. He's not burdened by even drive for money or lust for or even sadism, which I think is something which would probably have caused a lot of people to fall by the roadside as they got caught up in just basically the joy of being a sadist and having a free reign over so many people. So he's able to focus all his energies on trying to get power, and he's moving up rather rapidly, and he becomes important for that reason, among others.
Well, it's quite a book, and I'm going to guess that you, with all the body of information that you had, it was kind of like putting together a puzzle to put all these different real facts together with your fictional plot.
Yes, and I must admit, as I said before, I didn't really intend to do anything other than expand upon some of my ideas in my head, and so the plot developed around those ideas and incidences that I was just trying to work through. And so I broke every rule of writing a book, I suppose, in that sense. I wrote it as I like to read, though, and I allowed people to develop because they became extremely real. There is no character based on anybody else, but they themselves gained their own reality. And they were forced by events into certain actions, and they were forced by their own personalities into certain reactions. And it was amazing how often things happened I didn't expect, and I had to deal with it, and they had to deal with it. And so there are people who meet unhappy ends that I didn't expect that to happen, and it broke my heart, and they'd sort of argue with me about it and say, hey, I don't want this to happen to me. But I imagine that's what happened to a lot of people in the world in real life. And one of the things that is really quite disturbing about a lot of our movies and TV is that you sort of know in advance who's the one that's going to survive and who's going to die, because they're sort of picked out. It's like Star Trek,
right,
with the security guard. You know, this is the first time you see him, and you know when Kirk sends him behind that rock, that's the last time you're going to see him. And you know, meanwhile, that the three, you know, lead officers are always going to come out unscathed, maybe with a torn shirt.
But when there is a fatality, you always have a really good reason for that. And in a lot of instances, we don't know there's really a fatality. We don't know. I mean, it's like a person's gone. You don't know if they're dead or where they are. This is the kind of a world where people disappear and reappear with a new name. And Peter's a classic example of someone, you don't know where he is, you don't know who he is, you don't know where he's going to turn up next. Nobody knows, not even him.
Yes, he perhaps is the most mixed up of all the characters. But I think a lot of it is reflected in genuine history. The book in front, the front of the book is dedicated to a 15-year-old girl who died in 1945. And her family story was that she was taken, her father was sent in one direction, and she and her mother, along with four other children, were sent in a different direction. And they never knew whether they would see each other again. And they also didn't know, a lot of people, when they'd come back, just never knew what happened. They never found out. And there were so many people who just never came back. And in this case, the family did reunite. The at one point, while they were the mother and children were doing their slave labor, it was decided that you could keep two or three children with you, but you couldn't keep as many as four or five. And so the mother was going to lose a couple of her children, and they'd be sent off in yet another direction. And so she told the eldest daughter to pretend that the youngest daughter was her baby. And that way she was able to keep three children as hers, and her daughter kept the baby. And so they could stay together. And when they came back, almost miraculously, the father came back as well at the end of the war. And then the girl, the 15-year-old, who had been marched around Europe for no clear reason. I mean, obviously she didn't serve any great purpose in the war effort, just collapsed and died. And it was sort of extremely tragic listening to the mother. You know, they're a mother bearing a child. If you're a parent, you know how terrifying and tragic that is, to ever think that your child is not going to survive you. And to this day, I can see how she just cried 40, 50 years later, I forget when it was, and she you know, still talking about her daughter. And at the time, her daughter would have been about 50 years old. So she would have been there, and her children would have been there, and perhaps grandchildren. And she was just gone forever for what must have been the stupidest reason on earth. You know, just somebody's idea to just reorganize everything and send people all over the place to work, and in a way that was had to be the most idiotic use of labor in the world. And it was something that, you know, she just didn't get over. And that was, well, I guess one of the starting points in my mind about how these things, you know, they just don't go away. And you'd think if somebody, maybe a few more people had a bit of backbone back when it mattered in 39 or 33 or whatever, such a thing could have been avoided. And to have a backbone, you have to have information, and accurate information. And seeing people nowadays sort of just automatically assume, well, the best happened, and, you know, this has had to happen, and not knowing that anything else could have happened is a very, very worrying thing. And also seeing people start reneging on their individuality and joining groups and being told that your group is the most important thing, whatever it might happen to be, that is also quite disturbing. And I think that the message is, you know, we are individuals responsible for our individual actions, and maybe we should also look at the world with an open mind and find out what's going on so that, you know, we can take action in time. Something as simple as like Silent Spring, you know, this, it was important to get that message out then and there, and one person could do it.
Mm-hmm.
And but you, of course, you had to be informed. And now, you know, we've accepted the importance of, you know, pesticide control and things like that. Being informed and seeing an addiction, especially in American culture, growing addiction to non-news and to easy news and to news that's basically soap opera news.
What are you talking about?
I don't know what the current story is, but I had the wonderful advantage of being able to leave and come back. And it would be hilarious because there would be somebody in the news who we hadn't heard of at all, but they would be everywhere. And I'd say, well, who's that? I don't know. And
that's Jan yet, Stroyer.
That's right. making non-news.
just kidding. I totally agree with you. I'm just teasing you a little bit. That's the way I am. My guest is J.N. Stroyer. The book is The Children's War. And don't be intimidated by the size. This is the Shaquille O'Neal of books. It is huge. Maybe you've never read a 1,000-page book before. I'm telling you, this is one of the fastest reads, one of the greatest reads you're going to run into. If you're looking for a book to take along with you on vacation, I read a lot of books, and I think this is one that I would pick. If I hadn't already read it, I would take it on vacation this year. I mean,
and just carrying it around will probably do good for your health.
I mean, weightlifting. I made a joke to somebody. I said I had to be fitted with a truss just to read the darn thing, you know? The Children's War by J.N. Stroyer. And reading your biography as it is in the press materials, they allude to the fact that you've had some very interesting jobs. Now, tell me about this sharpshooting thing.
Oh, it was just something I wanted to know more about. I figured if there's a society full of guns around you, you ought to know how to shoot one. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to believe in carrying them or you know, putting them on the back of your pickup truck, but I figured I at least ought to know something about it. And so I took up on the opportunity to use an Army course and was a sharpshooter.
You got pretty good, too, didn't you?
Oh, yes. I mean, if you're going to do it, you might as well do it right.
And you also, did you work in a steel mill?
Yes, that was something else I did in my quest for money.
Now, where are you from? Are you from Pennsylvania?
From Northeast Ohio.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. So the Youngstown area.
This is like a homecoming in a way.
In some ways, yes. Yes, there's some, which is one reason why Dayton became, as you said, the center of the literary universe, as I especially requested a sort of visit to the old stomping ground. Dayton's not quite the old stomping ground, more up in Cleveland area. But,
Had you ever been to Yellow Springs before?
No, I haven't.
Well, hey, here you are.
Yes. She's
finally made it to Yellow Springs. J.N. Stroyer, the book is A Children's War.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest was J.N. Stroyer, and this interview was recorded back in 2001 for her extraordinary novel, The Children's War. We'll bring you one more segment with J.N. right after this. You are listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Going back 18 years for my interview with J.N. Stroyer for The Children's War.
What exactly is it that you do?
I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you.
Okay, go ahead. This is live radio, or it could be dead radio.
No, it's...
Is it top secret?
More tedious. If you want to get me onto physics, I could really bore your readers to tears.
Could you do it in like 60 seconds? Just briefly, kind of give us an overview of what it is that you actually do.
I could do it in one word: research.
Ooh, that could mean a lot of things.
That could mean a lot of things. Yeah, and right. So I going into great detail about what I research and why and where and how is not particularly interesting.
But they have good computers, don't they? I bet they've got some really great computers where you are.
Probably.
I'll bet they.
Yeah.
She's not going to tell me anything about it.
That was the only section of the book I was asked to rewrite, is the technical section with computers. And I was asked if I could just tone it down a bit. And I felt sort of bad about that because I thought, gee, if anybody who knows a bit about cryptanalysis reads this, they're going to think, you know, what an idiot.
So they made you dumb it down?
Not dumb it down. They very politely asked, could you shorten it and simplify it? And I said, well, you know, if it's short and simple, it wouldn't be hard to do. But I did just sort of make it look very easy to do. And as I told the editor, you'd just be thankful I didn't put any equations in the book. And so.
Okay. Well, it's the first book, and it's almost 1,200 pages long. And knowing American publishers a little bit, I'm thinking, even though it's a brilliant book and it's a wonderful read, that publishers probably thought you were crazy when you tried to sell it to them. What happened? How did you get this book published?
Oh, I thought they were crazy for accepting it. I have to admit, it existed solely on a computer for so long. I had no clue how long it was, and I had no clue what a standard book was. I never took a proper English course in my life, and so I didn't, or a writing course or any of that sort of thing. And so at one point, I picked up what I thought was a reasonable size book and sort of did a statistical estimate of the number of words in it and said, oh, I guess I've written a long one, at which point I hadn't yet thought about for sure that I even wanted to offer it up for publication. There's a lot of personal stories in there, not my personal stories, but other people's. And I wanted to clear with them that it was okay to even consider, you know, presenting this to strangers. And so I first had to do that, and then I had to sort of reorganize it a bit so that it became more of a something that might be acceptable to publishers. And then I just grabbed the first couple chapters and Xeroxed them and sent them out to a few publishing houses. I was living in New York at that particular time, so I just opened the phone book and looked them up. And they almost...
Seriously? That's what you did?
Yeah. I don't know anybody in the literary industry at all. And so I just thought, well, fine, I'll send it off to Random House or whoever. And they all said, we only deal with agencies. Uh-huh. And so I sort of didn't even seem to look at it. And at that point, I was thinking, oh, I guess I have to look under, you know, A in the phone book for agents. But one of them sent, for some unknown, very kind reason, sent me 40 pages of something I'd never heard of before, and that's the Literary Marketplace.
Uh-huh.
And they had Xeroxed it for me, or maybe for any aspiring writer. And so I just stuffed a few envelopes, sent it out blind. And by that point, I had moved back to Germany again. And so, you know, when they said self-addressed stamped envelope, I thought, well, gee, I don't really want to spend the money on them telling me they don't want it. And I figured if they are so poor they can't afford to actually send me a yes, I'm not interested in them. And so I didn't send any, I didn't get any rejections because people didn't bother. No, even then, I guess some of people did send back and say, you know, not our genre or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But one agent asked to see more, and I sent them more, and weeks passed, and I thought, well, okay, they realized that was perhaps not their cup of tea. And then they called and said, you know, we want to represent you. By the way, can we see the rest of the book? And I was sending diskettes. I said, no way. You know, I had not bought, I'm a bit of a conservationist, and I didn't want to waste paper printing it.
Uh-huh.
And so I sent them diskettes and let them deal with it that way.
Let them waste the paper.
Well, they could have read it on their computer screens if they had been good conservationists.
But this is America. No, I'm just kidding.
Trees are for chopping.
You mentioned the term genre, and you cross so many genres with this book. You've got suspense, you've got the mystery, you've got the thriller, you've got the romance. There's romance in this book.
Yes, I guess it's about a world, and so you have to cover everything in the world if you want to make it rural. Not everything. I mean, at some point I said, I guess we're not going to go into detail about that. But for the people to be real, they have real lives, and that includes things as diverse as you said.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's an impressive book, and as I say, I read a lot of books, and this is one of my favorites so far this year. It's called The Children's War by J.N. Stroyer. A lot of times I'll finish a book 5 minutes before the author walks in, especially a book of any length, and I'm happy to say I finished this book yesterday.
Well, you're working ahead, aren't you?
I wanted to know what happened. I had to get to the end, and I was not disappointed.
That's good to hear.
I
also want to know what happens next, I must admit.
Now, are the movie offers rolling in at this point?
No, not yet. I'm sure that Spielberg or somebody will just really want to do it, but no movie offers yet.
Don't be sarcastic. Don't belittle your talent
and
here.
And don't you worry about those action figures. They'll be out there, too.
We'll be able to go to McDonald's and get the Peter Halifax action figure with cast included.
With cast included, or the little assassin dolls.
We'll have a Zosia doll.
Yes, for Christmas.
Is it Zosia?
Zosia, yes.
Zosia. She's another enigma. Maybe it's a bloodline
perhaps
thing.
You realize she's perhaps a bit more wounded by her environment than she first lets on. And she comes across to me, I think, originally as just the golden girl with everything going her way, and yet you realize she really and truly is a screwed up little and has a lot of problems. And it's partly because that's one of the things the children's war is that they've inherited a war and they don't have a clue, really, about what normal life is like. And you see this in so many other places. You see it in anywhere where there has been an ongoing war or refugee camps. I mean, there's certainly children who've grown up, spent their entire life in refugee camps, and then they strap a bomb to themselves and go and do something insane. And you say, why did they do that? Well, you have to imagine what it was like. You know, their entire life, they have a completely different set of standards. And that is an important thing to remember, is that these things affect people. And then these people will then affect you. And so perhaps stopping something before it goes too far is important. Just letting people know a bit about what normal or peaceful life is like is important.
Well, I'm delighted to say that we've been talking about The Children's War for 40 minutes, and we haven't given away any of the wonderful secrets enclosed in this book, and that's for you, the reader, to discover. J.N. Stroyer worked very hard to create this book, and I think that you're going to enjoy reading it. I can't say enough good things about this book, and for people who listen regularly, they know that's not like me to babble on like that. So
I'm afraid we don't pick you up in Frankfurt, so I'll have to believe you.
They could listen online.
Are you online?
Yeah, they could listen on the computer.
Okay, well, I'll have to pass that news on.
Yeah, tell them to listen in Frankfurt to the book nut. Of course, they'd probably be in the middle of the night there, but they could listen.
No, it's not that bad.
Jenny, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
That was Jenny Stroyer talking about her book, The Children's War. And she put out a second book in that trilogy called A Change of Regime back in 2004. And I did an interview with her about that second book for my blog at the Dayton Daily News. And it sheds a little extra light on how she got the idea for the story. I'm going to read you a little bit from our written interview that I did with her. I asked her to tell us how you got the idea for these alternate histories, when does the historical divergence occur, and why Germany? And she replied, "That's quite a question. I'll answer the short one first. The divergence occurs in 1941 when, because of a dream, Hitler decides not to invade the Soviet Union. He is also convinced to pursue nuclear weapons more vigorously. Without an Eastern Front and with the war in the West having gone nuclear, America concedes that Europe is lost to democracy and an uneasy truce is established. Given the U.S.'s concession to Stalin after World War II, in that independent countries and the loyal allies against the Nazis were handed to him on a platter, this is not at all unlikely. The idea for these books began in 1980 when I traveled to Poland to meet relatives. It was the first meeting of our two branches of the family since they separated 75 years before. Names, faces, and stories came alive. I was particularly moved by my great aunt showing me the grave of her daughter, who died from 4 years of slave labor. The sorrow that one could hear in her voice, even after so many years, was heartbreaking. I rather naively thought, someone should tell Americans about this. At the time, our view of World War II suffering focused almost exclusively on the extermination camps, and therefore many people were inclined to dismiss the evils of Nazism as something that could not have affected them because they were not Jewish. I felt that the experiences of these others might make the dangers of such totalitarian philosophies more real. I also felt that their sacrifices deserve some recognition, especially those of resistance fighters who gave everything to fight Nazism, only to be sold out to communism, and usually death afterwards. Then reality set in. These were old stories from foreigners who spoke an incomprehensible language, and as citizens of a communist country were our enemies. Who could possibly care about their history? I put the idea on hold and continued my career in physics, which took me to foreign lands and introduced me to many diverse people. In particular, I traveled through the East Bloc. Theoretical physics was one of the standard escapes from totalitarian tedium, and met asylum seekers who lived in Belgium, England, and Germany. Time and again, I came across the same sorts of stories, and this time they were modern. I was appalled, but also cynical. So I began to research a bit, and the more I learned, the worse I felt. Yet now the situation was even worse. I wanted to tell the stories of non-European foreigners, people whose lands had never known democracy. It would be all too easy to write them off as so totally alien as to be irrelevant to the American experience. Anyway, I was up against a greater wall. I had no concept of their lives. I had no experience of their culture, background, or language. All I knew was the people I met face to face and their humanity. That was from my interview with Jan Stroyer for my blog back in 2004. We have time for a little musical interlude. Let's listen now to Bill Morrissey.
She took off her apron and joined him in the booth. This wasn't any time in her life to be held back by the truth. He picked up his napkin, wiped across his mouth, as she'd have done just about anything that night to get that right down south. He told her his name, and then she made up one that didn't match her name tag. He never realized what she'd done. He said, it's 2 days to Atlanta, and I push it hard each day. She said, I don't have much money. He said, you won't have to pay. But she knew strangers don't do favors, and nothing comes for free. You've got to pay for everything, it's just with different currency. He asked, how soon can you leave? She said, I don't have much to pack. He said, I'll meet you in my Chevrolet. I'm parked around the back. Well, the sidewalk was still glassy from the afternoon's ice storm, and it took her just a second to shed her waitress uniform. She left it on the floor, back to jewelry and some clothes. Always leave some things behind, no matter where she goes. There was the car, just like he said, shining in the light. And she could see a silhouette behind the wheel, and everything looked all right. There's only so much snow and cold you can take, so many strangers' eyes, till you have to get yourself back home and fill your family full of lies. Well, it wasn't much to look at, but she didn't really care. She was pretty sure his car was good enough to get her all the way down there. She leaned back in the seat, just another bird on the wing. He said, you know, this ride's a trade-off. She said, yeah, isn't everything? This is another winter song. They sat at each end of the couch, watched as the fire burned down so quiet on this winter night. Not a house light on for miles around. And he said, I think I'll fill the stove. It's getting time for bed. She looked up. I think I'll have some wine. How about you? She asked. And he declined. And Warren, she said, maybe just before tonight, let's fill the stove with birches. Watch as the fire burns bright. How long has it been? I know it's quite a while. Pour yourself half a glass. Stay with me a little while. Warren, he shook his head as if she'd made some kind of joke. Birches on a winter night, no, we'll fill the stove with oak. Oak will burn as long and hot as a July afternoon. And birch will burn itself out by the rising of the moon. And you hate a cold house, same as me. Am I right or not? All right, that's true, she said. It was just a thought that she said, Warren, you do look tired. Maybe you should go up to bed. I'll take care of the wood tonight. Oak, he told her. Oak, she said. Well, she listened to his footsteps as he climbed up the stairs. As she pulled a sweater on her and set her wine glass on a chair, she walked down cellar to the wood box. It was as cold as an ice chest. Then climbed back up with four logs, each as white as a wedding dress. And she filled the stove and poured the wine. Then she sat down on the floor and she curled her legs beneath her as the fire sprang to life once more. And it filled the room with its hungry light, and it cracked as it drew air, and the shadows danced a jittery waltz like no one else was there. As she stood up in the heat, as she twirled around the room, and the shadows, they saw nothing but a young girl on her honeymoon. And she knew the time, it would be short, soon the fire would start to fade. She thought of heat, she thought of time, and she called it an even trade.
That was the late Bill Morrissey recording one of my favorite songs live in studio. Once upon a time, Bill died a few years back, and Bill came through to see me that day to play some music and to talk about his only novel, Edson. And it's really a great book if you ever get a chance to track it down. Edson by Bill Morrissey. It's kind of autobiographical, I think. And that was it for the Best of the Book Nook. My 2001 interview with J.N. Stroyer. Before that, tune in tomorrow at 10:30. We'll go back to 2001 for a very strange interview with a couple of guys and a bunch of bottles of wine. 10:30 tomorrow morning.